Attack of the Final Girls is a podcast about the horror genre, so listener discretion is advised. Please check the show notes for specific content warnings for this episode. And of course, beware of spoilers.
This is episode 6.
Wow. Okay. Is this technically the first one that we've recorded this year of 2022?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, with the COVID thing, we did not escape it, unfortunately. And the first part of this year was super hectic. So we had our own little horror story happening at the beginning of this year.
Life's gonna life and COVID's gonna COVID.
Exactly. But hopefully, crossing fingers, we'll be good for a little while anyways. We got our boosters, so that makes me feel better a little bit anyways.
Yeah.
But we wanted to do best of 2021. So that's what we're here to tell you about, is our favorite movies of 2021. And we didn't actually do any of these for the podcast either, so it'll be kind of interesting to just, like, quickly talk about them.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what happens when you launch a podcast in November.
Yes, that's true. I think we only saw, like, 2 of these movies since we've been recording for the podcast.
Yeah, that would be about right.
Maybe 1. Anyways, so yeah, we're going to do our best of 2021. They're not in any particular ranking, because who can decide? Also, ranking is impossible.
And it's hard. I do it for my radio show with the albums, and it's painful, and I don't like it.
It's like, we could probably just lump these all together and still have good feelies about it.
Oh, yeah.
If they're near top of the list, then it's a pretty good sign that it's good enough that you're going to remember it. So I'm just going to do these randomly, because I totally had mine in a list. But, I'm also the type of person where if you ask me tomorrow, this might be a totally different list.
That's why I don't like ranking things. I'm like, you know, what is my mood? What is the position of the planets in the universe? Is Mercury retrograde, which it is right now? You know, it's all of those things.
People often are like, what's your top 3 movies? And it's like,
I hate that question.
I can't even tell you. Like, from day to day, I'm like, oh, wait, I forgot about this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I forgot about this movie. Or I might watch one movie and then it just, like, strikes me and I'm completely taken aback by it again. Mm-hmm. So impossible to rank stuff.
Yeah.
Let's just not rank it.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Don't like it. Good.
Okay, so I'm just going to do these randomly. This is, I think, one of the first movies we saw last year. The Vigil. Totally flew under the radar. Mm-hmm. I think it was limited release, right?
It was, yeah. I think it was mostly streaming, but got a tiny, tiny theatrical release. This was still pretty early in the year when, like, you know, movie theaters were open, but not at full capacity in any regard. And so limited stuff was extra limited.
Right. And we definitely have a privilege that we kind of have an in at a local theater, and so they'll stream pretty much anything for us. And that's how we had the privilege of watching a couple of these movies on the big screen. But The Vigil, I think, was probably the earliest in the year, at least for the ones that we have on our list. It's on Hulu right now streaming, because I keep seeing it, and I'm like, do I want to rewatch it? I don't know. I kind of just want to sit with my feelings for a little bit, and rather than trying to rewatch it and then be like, oh, I already know what's going to happen. So what did you think of The Vigil?
I was really impressed with it. You know, so rarely do we see the Jewish experience represented in horror, and in a way that is culturally competent and is, you know, not Holocaust based.
Yes.
Which is, again, like, just really, really refreshing. So often if we do see Jewish culture and Jewish people and the tenets of the religion portrayed, it's in the context of the Holocaust, which, you know, like, as I've said in previous episodes, it's really nice when we can celebrate not just the pain of a culture, yes, and celebrate some of the things that makes it beautiful. And I think that although this was certainly a scary story and a sinister story, there were some things about the Jewish rituals of mourning the dead that were very beautiful. And I think a lot of people don't know a lot about. And it was just really nice to see that on the big screen.
Yeah, totally. I thought the exact same thing. Being able to see Jewish Orthodox religious tradition, because, I mean, the movie is centered around Yaakov, who is somebody who has recently left the Orthodox Jewish tradition and, like, attends a support group for it. but at the same time is kind of hard up for cash. And he gets contacted by a family friend and says, hey, you'll make a whole lot of money if you come sit Shiva with this woman. She has Alzheimer's. She's not all there. And we need somebody to sit Shiva with her husband. So we're getting to see a struggle between wanting to modernize, wanting to get away from being kind of shackled. That's what Yaakov feels, shackled to your Orthodox tradition, but at the same time wanting to honor somebody. And it is very powerful to see him truly want to honor someone's soul, because that's how they feel like they're, you know, they're guiding their soul, making sure nothing enters the body. I also thought the movie, it's pretty much entirely set within the four walls of the character's name is Mrs. Litvak, of her home. And it's claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. It's atmospheric. It is visually stunning. You definitely are put off. It's like dark pretty much the entire time, but in a way that you're like, okay, I understand this woman has gone to bed. She wants to turn everything down. But then you're questioning everything that's happening. You're looking in all the corners and all the shadows and looking over shoulders and things like that. So it was stunning. It like left me wanting to turn on all the lights after we got out of that movie. So
definitely, it's a great example of the fact that you can do really great horror with a very small cast, a singular setting, and it's all about, you know, it's less about what we see and about what we don't see. Yes. Or what we think we're going to see. This is a really great example of that. A movie that does a lot with very little.
It also left me extremely excited to see what the director is going to do next. The director's name is Keith Thomas, and he actually, I looked up to see what his upcoming projects are, and he is going to be doing the Firestarter remake this year.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. And he's also working on a, I think it's an anthology show. Don't know a whole lot about it yet, but it's going to be produced by Guillermo del Toro, and it's called Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities. So he's going to be working on that too. So, very excited. I love the movie. I want to watch it again. A little scared, too. So, and I also love a movie that leaves you with an ambiguous ending.
Yeah.
And this one definitely, it has that punch. So, that was definitely in my top for 2021.
Yeah, same.
Let's switch to streaming.
Okay.
We'll switch. So, 2021 was kind of a weird, an odd bird in terms of year, in terms of movie releases. So we had the privilege of being able to see some movies that didn't otherwise get a really big release, but also there were a lot of movies that came out that were only streaming. One of the ones that I loved, Juliet hasn't had the privilege of watching it quite yet.
Yeah,
but
we're getting to it.
We'll get there.
It's okay.
Is the Fear Street trilogy that Netflix released this year. And I didn't split the movies out. There's three movies. So part one's 1994, part two is 1978, part three is 1666. Okay. So I didn't chop them up because really it's viewable as one thing. Mm-hmm. It's one big thing. The movies stand apart, but I couldn't separate them. It would have been impossible. They're so much fun. I watched literally anything that Arl Stein has anything to do with. Mm-hmm. I watched the kids' Goosebumps movie when it came out. I love them. I grew up on the Goosebumps books. I freaking love the Goosebumps books. It also kind of, so it's a trilogy of films, but Netflix kind of released them like really closely together. I think it was like a week or two in between each episode or each entry into the series. So that was another reason why I didn't break it up. It's like, it's basically the same. It's kind of like a made-for-TV movie, you know?
Kind of like the original It.
Yes, exactly. So you have 1994, which honors the slashers of the 90s, so great. Lots of really gruesome, terrible kills. When you go back to 1978, it honors Friday the 13th. It honors Halloween. Mostly it's Friday the 13th. It's an homage to Friday the 13th. And then 1666 is sort of different because we go back to sort of like the Salem witch trials in a Puritan village. And we're getting more atmospheric horror, more witchcraft. And that movie is also 1666 is the end of it, and it kind of wraps the entire trilogy together and sets us back into 1994. So it's great on first watch. It absolutely has rewatchability. But You read the Fear Street books when when you were a kid.
Yeah, funny enough, I did not read the Goosebumps books. I went straight into Fear Street, and part of that is my age. I think that Goosebumps were out, but they weren't as popular. They got popular kind of when I read books that I was way too young for. That's part of this. But I had a neighbor who had all the Fear Street books, and she started passing them to me, and I started reading them and getting really into them, and I just love them. And I think by the time Goosebumps started to hit kind of my age group and sort of pop culture, I was like, why would I read those when I'm already reading Fear Street? And I think I was probably halfway to Anne Rice at that point. But I love those Fear Street books. Like, I can still remember... You know, I wish, actually, and I know they didn't do this with this one, but based off of the success of this one, I hope they do the Last Cheerleader trilogy at some point as a movie, because that was everybody's jam when I was a girl. I was like, oh my gosh, the cheerleader trilogy, you know, there was like the Babysitter and all these like really tropey ones. Now, like when you look back at it, it's like, here's stereotypical horror trope distilled into a book for teenagers.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
So I am really excited to see this. I'm a slacker when it comes to watching stuff on streaming. I'm busy. I'm just now getting caught up to like 2 years worth of streaming content. So that is on my list, and I'm really excited to hear it, especially based on your review of it.
Yeah. I have the privilege of working at home, so I'm pretty much caught up on all the streaming things. And I say that in sort of a shameful way, because I've watched probably more television in my life in the past 2 years than I have. Yeah, it's really bad. So Kiana Madeira is Dina. So she's like the main character of the three, and she plays different characters in each of the three.
I like that they did it that way.
Yes. I love seeing one actor in three different acts be something totally different.
Yeah.
It was great. And I only read a couple of the Fear Street books, so I'm not up on this series based off of the movies, but I will say, watching this as an adult, you absolutely get the feeling like, I'm watching something that my parents are going to be really upset. If they knew that I was watching this, they would be very upset with me. It's mature. There are queer love stories, which, if that's great to modernize it, R.L. Stine was involved with this, so it has his blessing, and I'm pretty sure he's linked up with Netflix for some more projects, so
yeah.
That's good to hear. I mean, nostalgia is in right now, so I think R.L. Stine's going to stay popular for a little while.
Definitely. And I think also, like, with sort of the height of R.L. Stine's popularity, you've got that thing where now a lot of people who grew up reading R.L. Stine are introducing it to their kids.
Yes.
You know, introducing his work to their kids or their nieces and nephews or, you know, the young people in their lives, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So really exciting to see what else R.L. Stine's going to have with Netflix or in general. And also definitely excited to see Kiana Madeira do more horror, because she was awesome in this series. I'm pretty sure she's going to be like a new Scream Queen. She's fairly young, but we love it. We love a new Scream Queen.
Yeah.
So
yeah. There are a couple more already from, not to get too far into Scream, but since we just saw Scream, there are a couple of actors in Scream that I'm like, yes, this is the next generation.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
That's so good. Okay, no more Scream talk.
Yeah,
no, we'll talk about that later.
We'll do it.
Okay, so I'm going to let's talk about Army of the Dead next.
Okay.
A movie that very uniquely was simultaneously released into the theaters, and then I think a week later put into streaming.
Something like that, yeah. And it was one that kind of went back and forth. Because of the pandemic, at certain points, we thought, oh, this is going to be streaming only because the theaters just weren't open or weren't, again, open to capacity. But it did end up getting a theatrical release, which was really exciting, because that is one that you definitely want to see on the big screen.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Just like any of Zack Snyder's movies, huge explosions, insane soundtrack. You want to hear it in Dolby surround in the movie theater. I'll pretty much watch anything that Zack Snyder makes, though. After the Dawn of the Dead remake, which was one of the very first zombie movies I ever saw, I got to see it in the drive-in, which zombie movies, not necessarily optimal viewing in the drive-in. But honestly, any movie, if you love the drive-in, any movie is great at the drive-in. But I basically gave him kind of carte blanche. I was like, I'll watch pretty much any zombie movie that you do. So.
Zombie movie, yes. I'm super hot and cold on him as a director overall. Mm-hmm. But, and I was kind of, especially because of all of the hype around the Snyder Cut of Justice League, I was kind of like, oh God, like, what is this, you know, this long epic zombie movie? Like, is this going to be, it could go either way.
Sure. But
really, I thought Army of the Dead honored and tapped into what made his Dawn of the Dead remake so great. Like, yes. It was that same spirit and that same love for the genre and going just a little over the top.
Yes.
In a lot of both hilarious and thoughtful ways. Yes. That made it a really, really fun watch.
Totally. And he pushed it over the top by having it set in Vegas. So yep. We've got showgirl zombies. We've got people freaking out inside of casinos. And we also have, and I love this, I'm such a sucker for this, his signature slow-mo beginning. Yep. And we've got Richard Cheese. He brought back Richard Cheese to sing the song. Love that. I loved it. And even though it was long, I think it was like 2:30, 2:45.
Yeah, it was pretty long.
It was fairly long. Even though it was long, at the end of it, I didn't feel like I had sat through a slog. I felt like all of the moments were filled. I didn't see any slow parts. I loved it.
Yeah, it was great. It almost felt like, stylistically, it could even fit in the same universe as his Dawn of the Dead.
Definitely. Definitely.
Which I love it when, even in my head, that can happen.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Like, they have little teeny tiny mentions of other outbreaks that are happening, mm-hmm. that this wasn't an isolated incident. Although, this is also, it felt so relevant because it was like kind of a post-mini-apocalypse world.
Right.
And so everybody's like kind of like wary. There's also refugees. We talk about refugees that are living just outside of Vegas that are having to be moved because their crazy president is getting ready to nuke Vegas.
I actually really appreciated that storyline, too. You know, the best zombie movies always reflect the sort of ills and evils of human society.
Yeah.
Like, always, you know, that was, of course, Romero's hallmark. And I thought the refugee storyline in particular was really, really great in its relevance.
Totally. Yeah. Because we have all these really fun characters, but we're also humanizing a fantastic storyline with having something very realistic. Like, what would happen if you had a zombie outbreak? You would have refugees. So,
yeah. And also, Tig Notaro was awesome in that movie.
Yes.
And was added, like, after the movie was shot.
Yes.
And I didn't know that until after I had seen it. Like, you would never know that just by watching it.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to give her props, too.
Yeah.
So Dave Bautista is in it. Hilarious.
Yep.
He's kind of, I feel like he's the other side of the coin from The Rock.
Oh, yeah.
The Rock is, like, kind of a serious, not, I don't want to say serious actor, like, I am in serious movies, but, like, he always kind of plays a character, like, a certain character, you know? I feel like Dave Bautista and John Cena now, because I've been binging the Peacemaker show.
Yeah, same.
I feel like both of them don't really take themselves too seriously, so they can be, John Cena's kind of like on the far end of that.
Yeah.
But Dave Bautista's like the middle range of like serious actor and goofy John Cena. Dave Bautista's like, no, I'm going to be in the zombie movie, but I'm going to play a nuanced character, a caring father, but also a brutal, you know, killer of zombies. So,
well, and he is somebody that I know is very discerning in the roles he takes. Mm-hmm. Like, he, because he's had so much success with wrestling and in Hollywood and everything else, he only takes roles that he thinks he can have fun with and
that's
do something
good.
With and create a nuanced performance. So that's why you don't see him in everything all the time, but when you see him, it's always going to be kind of a special performance, whether it's funny or it's typically very nuanced. Like, when we think about him in Guardians of the Galaxy, like, that is a nuanced part. Yes. And we see the same thing in Army of the Dead.
Yeah, he's not just like the big heavy guy, you know, or even really like the funny. He's not really a humorous role. He does say some funny things, but he's not really a humorous role. They leave that to Tignataro and other characters to kind of be the funny. And I didn't write this guy's name down, but the guy who plays the Safecracker,
he's fantastic.
He's kind of the funny, like the light levity of that. I did want to say too, Ana de la Reguera is in it. She's fantastic. If you haven't seen any of her other movies, you might have seen her in Nacho Libre across from Jack Black. She's hysterical in that. Omari Hardwick, Thea Rossi, which this is the first thing I've seen Thea Rossi in since Sons of Anarchy. So,
yeah, I don't know that I've seen him in anything since then either.
Wait, he was in a TV show. He was in The Luke Cage Show. I forgot about that.
Oh, right.
On Netflix. Right. Okay. So I forgot about that, but it was kind of a small role. Mm-hmm. And now we get him as a bad guy, which is kind of nice because he, like in Sons of Anarchy, he kind of played like, I am the good one of the terrible biker gang. But the Tignataro thing, I definitely, holy crap. So they had to replace Christy Elia at the last minute because of all of the underage relationship stuff that went on with him. So they brought in Tignataro, and I saw an interview with her, and she was like, yeah, I was in my office in front of a green screen recording myself with like fake machine guns to be entered into this movie. And my kids are outside the door like, what are you doing, Mom? I'm like yelling into the camera and all this stuff. They did a great job of entering her in seamlessly because she was not there with them at all. Yeah. During the filming of this, because all of her stuff was done afterwards. Fortunately, her character doesn't really have to be with the rest of the group for most of the time, but props to her. That's
definitely
amazing. Yeah. What an like modern film. What an amazing thing. So I love that one. I'll watch all of his zombie movies. I'm sure that this is not going to be the last one.
Yeah, I hope, because it's been so long since he's done a zombie movie, I hope that the response to this one and how great this one turned out inspires him to make more, because I would like to see him do more in the horror genre again.
Yeah, if for no other reason than to just watch cool explosions.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're pretty much back to just theatrical release movies. Let's do both the sequels.
Okay.
A Quiet Place Part 2.
Okay, yeah. So this was one of my highly anticipated films. This is another one that was actually supposed to come out in 2020. So we had been seeing that first trailer for like 2.5 years, it felt like. And it was another one that I think there were some concerns that at some point when a lot of theaters were kind of making that call, or I'm sorry, a lot of film companies were making that call to shift things to streaming just to get them out in the world. This was one I was really concerned about because I feel like A Quiet Place is such a theatrical franchise. Mm-hmm. Because of the use of sound, the really complex use of sound. But it was fantastic. And you wonder with such a singular movie like A Quiet Place, how are they going to follow that up? Mm-hmm. And if they follow it up, is it going to feel too redundant to mm-hmm. the first film? And this definitely did not mm-hmm. do that. It really brought us more background, more context to what the characters are experiencing, brought us a couple of new characters, but really kept with the core family and moved the story forward in a way that was really refreshing and didn't feel overly repetitive from the first one.
Yeah. Mentioning the trailer thing, we've lived in such a weird time paradox in the past 2 years that there are several movies where I'm like, I don't ever want to see this trailer ever again. Yeah. And this was one of them because I was so excited about the movie. I'm like, stop teasing me. Mm-hmm. Just make a date. It was like that with No Time to Die with James Bond. I just didn't want to see the trailer anymore. Mm-hmm. But
even that first Halloween Kills trailer.
Oh, my gosh. Like,
we saw it so many times, and it was, is it, isn't it? Is it, isn't it?
Is it going to get pushed back again? Are we not going to get this until Halloween 2022? What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. This is actually, this movie and the reception of it afterwards when we were talking about it is part of the reason why, like, this kind of sowed the seed for me to even think about doing this podcast is because I'm like, I don't want to hear what everybody else has to say about movies. I just want to hear what Julia has to say. But normally sequels are always going to take a lower place for me in any type of movie. If we're talking about reboots and TV shows, reboots and movies, they're always going to be a little bit lower for me. And that's kind of what I thought. I had relegated this one already. Like, I loved A Quiet Place. I don't know about the sequel. This one completely broke the mold. John Krasinski absolutely has proven that he's more than just Jim Halpert on The Office. He is an accomplished writer. He has great ideas. He's an insane director. What you were saying about background, it gives you just enough where you're like, I want to know more, a little bit more, because in A Quiet Place, we're kind of dropped into this story and we don't really have any idea what's happening. But this one gives you just enough of a taste that you're like, yes, I want to know more about this. There's heart-stopping action sequences. Mm-hmm. Holy cow. Multiple times when you're like, I don't have any idea what's going on. And then you're scared out of your seat. He also has this really good way of drawing you into a scene and then slamming you in the face with a jump scare. And you're like, I'm terrified. Yeah. I need to leave right now. I also wanted to talk about Millicent Simmons. She was in the first one as Reagan. She's Evelyn's daughter. So Emily Blunt is Evelyn. John Krasinski was the dad. I didn't even write his name down because he's not in this one. But Millicent Simmons, she's a deaf actress. Amazing that they brought her a disability into the movie, into the first movie and into the second movie, as not necessarily a disability in a world where you have to be silent because of these monsters. It's her superpower.
Yeah.
That she can exist in a world and live in a world where there is no sound. So, yeah.
And it also, you know, and part of this is just the fact that we focus pretty exclusively on the family, though we do see in some of the flashback content, the fact that she's hearing impaired, the fact that she uses American Sign Language, it's not like this unusual thing. Like even, you know, it's certainly not in the context of their family, you know, they're all able to communicate very well with each other. But even in the context of the town, the few little scenes we get of, you know, the baseball game and things at the town, she is communicating with her neighbors and her community, and she's an active part of her community, you know, and it's not like, oh, there's, you know, air quotes, the deaf girl or whatever. She's mm-hmm. just, you know, a person existing in the world. And that's just such a refreshing take to see in film in general. Like, we don't have enough portrayal of people with disabilities as just like people living out their lives in society, let alone heroes in horror films. Mm-hmm. So I just really, I hope that this film will represent, this franchise will represent a turning point, or will inspire other directors and storytellers to feature, especially more disabled actors too, mm-hmm. in roles that really elevate them.
Definitely. The first one is really good, and this one does what a sequel does best, which is it absolutely enhances the first movie. Mm-hmm. It's not going over tired tropes. It's not hitting you in the head with all of the lessons from the first movie. It's a fresh take. It's more information. It elevates the first movie, and that leaves you wanting more. I mean, honestly, I would watch a third installment of this.
So I just read, like, this morning that they are doing something with the franchise. There's going to be a video game.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. But
there's also just started to be talk of a third film. And what we don't know is if it's going to be a third film telling the story of this family, or if they're going to like expand it out and maybe we're going to experience this event in another place through other people or whatever. But there's just started to be some rumblings about that, which I'm really excited about.
It's always really nice when a monster film is still scary, because it's really easy to transition monster movies into being action films, like The Kong vs. Godzilla. But this one really stays very scary. It stays suspenseful. The folks in the film don't know exactly what's happening either, because communications are down. So I like being in a film where I know just as much as the protagonists know. We're all on the same page. We're experiencing it through their eyes, and we have just as much information. So it's like a kind of a pure, it's like a really being inside the film.
Yeah.
For me. So loved that one. I'll watch, if they make 10 of these movies, I'll watch all 10 of them. Same. I don't even care. So let's talk about Candyman.
Okay. Another highly anticipated film. You know, this is another one that we saw trailers for a long time, and the release date got moved around. And again, just like A Quiet Place, there was some very real concern at various points during the pandemic that this was not going to get a theatrical release. And thankfully it did. I really loved this one, and I also got really, really frustrated with some of the discourse leading up to the film because, you know, a lot of people were saying based on the trailers, they're like, oh, Candyman's going woke. And I'm like, do you know the Candyman franchise? Like,
did you watch any of them?
Did you watch any of them? Like, so there was that surrounding the film, you know, and of course, as we were leading up to this film, you know, certainly in, you know, a post Breonna Taylor, post George Floyd summer of 2020 atmosphere, I could see how people were, how it was more obvious to people. But again, if you've seen this, if you know this franchise, you know that this type of storytelling was right in line with mm-hmm. what the originals were doing.
Totally. Yeah. So the first Candyman movie is really near and dear to my heart. Mm-hmm. I love the first Candyman movie. My first introduction to Tony Todd, which we love Tony Todd.
Oh, yes.
And in this house, we worship Tony Todd.
Yes.
So there's a lot of talk about reboots and sequels and things like that. Reimaginings of movies, requels, whatever, where people are upset by it. And you can't please everybody. But I think that this movie is an example of what a revitalization of a franchise needs to be, which is honoring the old, honoring what has come before, the good parts of what has come before.
Yeah.
But also making important, having something to say about what's happening currently.
Yeah.
Which, to your point, it had something solid to say about gentrification in Chicago, which, I mean, gentrification is happening all over America, but since it's set in Chicago, we're talking about gentrification. We're talking about appropriation of old urban legends. Mm-hmm. We're talking about using and misusing urban legends. And then also bringing them into new myths, or what are the next chapters in these old urban legends? And also the idea of generational trauma, which I think was lost on a lot of folks who were watching this movie. And it's like, the first Candyman is literally about generational trauma.
Yeah.
And like generational trauma moving through a family and moving through a franchise and urban legend, you know, and then resting inside of bodies in the modern world. And so I think that had, it definitely had a lot to say about that. I freaking love this movie. As soon as we got out of the theater, I was like, I loved it.
Yeah, same.
I thought it was great.
Yeah. I loved the conversations about gentrification in particular, because, and, you know, this is me saying this, and I know that other people would probably have a different opinion about this, but I did not find it preachy at all. Mm-mm. Like, you get this conversation in the context of the characters having this conversation and characters calling each other's bluff and calling each other out about, like, well, you're sitting here making art about gentrification in this beautiful high-rise apartment, for example. And I love, mm-hmm. I love stuff like that, that just pokes just a little bit. And that characters can have those conversations for us and with us, mm-hmm. is fantastic. That's what I love to see on the big screen. I know some viewers are probably going to say, well, it's too preachy. Well, you know.
I think it's a reflection of making themselves feel uncomfortable, yeah, and not really definitely. Like sitting with that or realizing that it's okay for you to feel uncomfortable about this because you're supposed to feel uncomfortable about this, but that's not necessarily, you don't need to fight against this. You yeah. should realize those feelings, understand where they're coming from, and then work to, you know, make things more equitable.
Yeah.
Because I love, like, that scene where they're kind of all sitting in this apartment just talking back and forth. And they're like, yeah, you make, you know, art. You're selling art. You want to sell art for millions of dollars that is based off of gentrification. And you're literally living in a place that used to have projects.
Yeah.
And you're three or four blocks away from where projects still exist.
Yeah.
So I didn't think it was preachy at all. It's just like any movie that's going to talk about very, like, now topics, you know, air quotes, now topics that are kind of hot button issues, people are going to feel uncomfortable. So they're going to rail against it.
Yeah.
And because of that, they're going to miss out on so much of what the story is trying to say.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. Yeah. You can be simultaneously entertained and challenged.
Totally. Like, I feel like a lot of the movies that we watch are both of those things at the same time. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, He plays Anthony McCoy. He's the main character. He's our next entry into the Candyman. You'll see him in the trailer. He's the one that has the bees coming out of him. Tiana Paris as his girlfriend, Brianna Cartwright. Coleman Domingo played William Burke, who is kind of our... he's a secret. I'm not going to say more about him.
We'll just say he's our guide
yes.
through some of this. Yeah.
Yes. Every single one of them, fantastic acting. Loved it. I felt like this linked into the first entry of the Candyman series and pulled it into, like, the modern time.
Yeah.
And set us up in such a way that we could absolutely have more of these films. I don't know if that's going to happen. I hope so.
Yeah, I haven't heard. I don't think I've heard either way on that one yet.
And listen in for a Tony Todd cameo in that movie.
Yes.
Because that, like, made me yell out loud. I was like, yes! So, okay, so that was the last of the sequels. Let's talk about PG Psycho Goreman.
Okay.
Another movie that we had the privilege of seeing in the theater that did not get a wide release.
Yeah. A lot of people got to experience this one on Shudder and heard about this making, like, big waves on Shudder. We did get to stream it on the big screen through some very nice local connections. This movie surprised the hell out of me because I don't typically like horror comedies. I just don't typically like horror comedies. They're usually a little too over the top for me in a way that just doesn't work, in a way that I feel like panders a little bit. That's just me. I'm no fun. And I also typically don't love movies that center on kids as the main character. And, you know, for a variety of reasons. But this one really, really delivered. It was hysterical. Like, I was just cracking up the whole time.
I can't even count the number of times I, like, was scream laughing
in
the theater. If you can just step outside your head for a minute and imagine Mighty Morphin Power Rangers villains in the real world that have somehow come under the control of a tiny little girl, and she makes him a pet and she's completely unafraid of him and not scared at all. This is the movie for you.
Yeah.
It's basically it.
And it does not compromise on gore or creative kills.
Oh my gosh.
It goes there with a lot of practical effects, which is always great to see. Mm-hmm. The humor in it is so great because it's absurdist to just a beautiful level. Like, if I'm going to laugh at something as much as I laughed at this, it's got to go pretty sublime in the humor, and this definitely does that. And it's also, the kids are, they're fun and they're believable as kids, and they just have a lot of personality. The little girl in particular just cracked me up because she reminds me of several of my friends' kids in, like, the best possible way.
Yeah, like, she has utter control over her parents.
Yeah,
they're middle class, like, they live in a suburb, but a terrifying planet killer alien crashes down into this area and she makes a pet of him in this, like, weird abandoned warehouse. Like I said, I was scream laughing. Stephen Kostanski is the director of this movie. So he worked on The Void, which I loved that movie when it came out, and it also kind of flew under the radar just like this one. But before that, he made a movie called Manborg, which was ultra low budget, absurdist sci-fi film where he was using, like, aluminum foil and, like, spare wires and stuff, and he was just hot gluing them to people and using green screen and, like, just, it's absolutely ridiculous. So it's nice to see a movie where somebody had thrown some money at him and they're like, okay, you make that Psycho Goreman suit. And also, Psycho Goreman isn't really the monster's real name. They just call him that.
Yeah.
That's like the quick 30 seconds of brainstorming that they're doing. But it's super funny. It does not take itself seriously at all. I've seen it a couple of times since we watched it initially, and it's just as funny, even though you know what's going on. When I say, think about Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, there are lots of characters and costumes. There's lots of weird villains. There's like the weird bucket villain that has just a bunch of body parts inside of him. Intergalactic Council, who doles out justice, kind of justice, air quotes justice. It's got so much happening in it. You'll have tons of fun. Definitely a movie that you can shut your brain off. There's nothing to read into this movie.
Yeah, no.
It has no message.
No.
Aside from, if you can make an intergalactic planet killer alien your pet, you should probably do it because it's fun.
Yeah, totally worth it.
Yeah. I love that movie. And I'll watch anything that Stephen Kostansky does. He actually worked on VHS 94, which just came out as well.
Oh, cool. Okay. So,
yeah.
That makes me want to see it even more, knowing that he worked on it.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're like, is it going to be crazy or is it going to be terrifying? Because he also works in practical effects, which I think is partly why Psycho Goreman is so heavy on the practical. And The Void is, too. Manborg, he's cutting his chops. He's making a low-budget sci-fi movie, which is fun. The Void, though, I couldn't watch it all the way through the first time. So Psycho Goreman, not as heavy as that one.
Nice.
Less Eldritch Horror, more pure, Power Rangers.
Pure ridiculousness.
Yes. I think that the last one is probably the one that we saw the chronologically last, Malignant.
Yeah, so people have really mixed feelings about it. I kind of love it. I think you have to understand, it's unfortunate in that it really is a horror fan's horror film. Like, if you're just coming into this fresh and you don't know what James Wan is pulling from, you're just going to be like, why did this director get this money to make this film? And also, like, just why? Now, if you know your horror background and you also know James Wan's appreciation for sort of the history of horror, it's brilliant. Like, it's so smart in terms of what he's doing and the types of performances he asked for from his actors and things like that. It's great, but it's a bit polarizing, because I think if you don't have that history, you might be a little lost and you might be saying, like, wow, this is trash.
Yes.
Now, if you're able to have fun with trash, you'll still enjoy it.
I absolutely agree with that. The movie starts out with this really kind of campy flashback scene where there's lots of like crazy lights happening and sound effects and kind of over the top dialogue. And I'm glad that it's, for me, I'm glad that it set this, like, it set the stage there, because I'm like, now I know what I'm getting into.
Yeah.
But I understand how that could have absolutely turned off a more serious moviegoer. Like, what is this? Because it's truly heavy on the camp.
Yeah.
That first little bit. As you're walking through this movie, you don't know if it wants to be a giallo film. You don't know if it wants to be body horror. Does it want to be an action flick? Is it a buddy cop movie?
All of the above.
Yes.
Is it an episode of The X-Files? Totally. It's that too.
Yeah. It kind of keeps you off kilter the entire time, because the movie doesn't know what it wants to be, so you have no idea. Is this a alien film? Is this a ghost story? Is this a body horror flick? Is this a science experiment gone wrong? A medical experiment gone wrong? All of those things. It's all of those things. The dialogue is really weird. I don't know if maybe I'm just being too critical now, because as we're watching movies, I'm like, okay, this is podcast fodder. And so am I being too critical of this? But I think the dialogue was just like really missed me. Yeah. A lot. I'm just like, who talks like this? People don't talk to one another like this. It was really weird, but I loved it. And I kind of want to watch it again.
Yeah, it's great. It's one that I suspect here in a couple of years is going to get really, really celebrated. It's another one that I think, unfortunately, there are still so many horror fans that can't or aren't or just don't yet feel comfortable going to the theater. And or they're really just like limiting their theater experiences to the really big ones, you know, your Halloween Kills, your Scream, etc. And they don't have the time or the bandwidth or the level of comfort to take a gamble on a film like this. But I suspect this is going to find its audience on streaming and home media, and it's going to become this thing where here in a couple of years, everybody's going to be going nuts about this movie and just talking about how brilliant it is.
Yeah.
Because it's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know what, like, what more I can say about it to add to it aside from just watch it, keep an open mind,
yeah.
just roll with the punches. Don't take this movie too seriously. As soon as you think you know what's going on, maybe you do a little bit, but there's going to be some more wrenches thrown into that.
I think the other thing to remember is, so we, in the horror world, we all know James Wan from the Conjuring movies, mm-hmm. and especially those first two, you know, The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2, were so serious, and the storytelling was really excellent, and they were really crafted in a very specific way that I love. The Conjuring is one of my favorite modern franchises. This is not that. And you really have to kind of just divorce yourself from the Conjuring franchise at all when watching this movie. It is not that story-wise. It's not that stylistically. You almost have to pretend like it's a different filmmaker, because those preconceived notions that you're going to go in with are, you're going to be disappointed. But if you go in with like a really open mind and just know like, this is not going to be The Conjuring, this is him doing something completely different, you're going to get something out of this. And like, more props to a director for doing something totally different and doing what they want.
Like, yeah, for sure. This definitely felt like a lot of things put together where he's like, I want to do all these things at the same time. Let's just jam a movie together.
Yeah.
But it kind of works.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It does.
Just don't take too seriously.
No.
Okay, so that's the last of the like tried and true horror movies, I guess you could say. But the very last one that I wanted to talk about, and not... I guess not technically a horror film, although some people could make the argument one way or the other, is Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not technically a horror movie, but this is definitely in the honorable mention. And I'm talking about honorable mention. It's a banner. It's made of rainbows. It's got sparklies on it. This is truly an honorable mention.
Yeah. And I feel like movies like Ghostbusters, you know, people go back and forth about whether or not they're horror films. But I believe that even if they aren't straight up like capital H horror films, they are adjacent to the genre and have a place sort of within the dialogue about the genre. Because how many people grew up and their first very early, safe, fun experience of ghosts and scary things on the big screen was a movie like Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. So for many, many fans, it helped pave the way and sort of prime them for, you know, loving scary things. So yeah. It's not a straight up horror film, but it certainly, that franchise has a place somewhere in the discussion of horror.
Yeah. We were really excited to see this. The trailers made it look really good. I love a Paul Rudd film. But Ghostbusters is one of those really delicate franchises where, unfortunately, some folks think that the first two movies are kind of holy, or even the first one is like a holy film, you know, and like religious holy, not like has holes in it. But it makes it so that people are very rigidly minded about any sort of follow-up or sequel to it. Which, unfortunately, the 2016 entry fell victim to, which is really sad, because really the only thing it didn't have going for it, I mean, the fallout afterwards has created a lot of issue, but there was a lot of really loud voices before the movie came out saying, the Ghostbusters can't be women,
right,
and this can't be a reboot. Like, you can't do that. It shouldn't happen. It doesn't have the blessing of Bill Murray. It's like, okay, well, things can be different.
And then the flip side of that is that I've then heard some equally loud voices leading up to Ghostbusters Afterlife. And I get it, but also it's so much more nuanced than that. That because of the fallout that happened after Ghostbusters 2016... are angry that Ghostbusters Afterlife was made, because they're seeing this as a sort of betrayal or as sort of kowtowing to the fans that didn't, you know, that said the Ghostbusters couldn't be women and you had to have the blessing of Bill Murray, et cetera, et cetera. And they feel like this movie is kowtowing to that, which I have a whole thing about fan service that we'll get to in some future episode. But, I don't think this is that either. You know, I think the thing with Ghostbusters 2016 is so unfortunately really, really complicated mm-hmm. for a good movie. The circumstances surrounding that movie really have messed up the way that a lot of people see that movie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, almost messed up the way a lot of people are seeing Ghostbusters Afterlife. I've had to tell several people, like, hey, no, you really need to give this a chance. Because mm-hmm. it was really good.
Yeah. It was almost like a family comedy, yeah. more so than it was a horror movie. But this movie was probably the one that, of all of the movies we saw in 2021, I had the most fun sitting and watching in the theater. I didn't ever feel like there was a slow point. I was uplifted with the characters. I felt low with the characters. I cried a little bit. I laughed my butt off. I feel like there were lots of weepy adults in the movie theater yes. after the end, but in a good way, like in a way where you're like, well, I'm really glad that this is how this polished out.
Yeah.
The action scenes are great. The CGI where they used it, also really good.
And also for people who did like the 2016 movie, please do not dismiss this movie because you need to see Grace McKenna's performance. Mm-hmm. She steals the entire movie.
Yeah.
And really they are setting up that she is the future of Ghostbusters. So don't, you know, don't make your sadness and your mixed feeling that the 2016 got such a bad reception make you miss out on this young actor's performance, because she is phenomenal in this movie.
Yeah. Juliet and I definitely talked pretty heavily about her after we watched this film. She is a character who is a nerd and she's misunderstood, and she has her nose in books and science experiments and projects and things. I came out of the theater, and I know Juliet did too, afterwards, thinking, if I had been a kid when I saw this movie, it would have been so important for me to see a portrayal like this, because as a girl who definitely grew up like that, having my nose in books, being kind of othered, and my parents not understanding where I'm at, because my parents were either outgoing or really workaholics, if I had been able to see someone be the hero of a movie and carry the movie along and be like the focus of the action that's happening, while also by the end of the movie never having to compromise those,
right.
that, you know, the nerdy features and the fact that she's super smart and that she really likes science, and also not being forced to come out of her shell anymore.
Yeah.
She is at her core the same as she was at the beginning of the movie. And when I was growing up in the 90s, I feel like so many nerdy girls, when you would start in a movie or a TV series, you'd have the nerdy girl, nose in a book, doing science experiments, but by the end she would have transformed into being outgoing and maybe leaving some of those things behind. Like, oh, I can't be both of these things at the same time. So seeing the main character of a movie stay that same person by the end, and that being her asset as being that girl, maybe she doesn't relate to people very easily, but that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was really cool. And it was just so special to me to see somebody portray that on the screen. She's an incredible actress. Can't wait to see more stuff that she's done.
Yeah. And never do we have a scene where, you know, never do we have the she takes the glasses off scene, or the, well, you know, she gets dressed up and goes to, she's a little young for the character's a little young for this, but, you know, gets dressed up in the pretty dress and goes to prom, but still manages to kick ass at the end. Like, no, yeah. She is herself, you know, in like a baggy sweatshirt or a work suit, you know, the entire movie. And I love that.
Yeah. And really, it was really satisfying to see everybody else come to her level,
yeah,
and rather than the other way around, because yeah. that's often how it happens. It's like, oh, I understand now that I need to change in order to be relatable to other people. It was more like all of the other people, Paul Rudd as the guy that the mom is dating, is kind of like, let me help you to understand her better. And her brother, who kind of understands her but also is like much older and like, oh, I gotta get girls and stuff, also is kind of on her level. And then, you know, some ancestral things happening, you know, to help bring everybody else onto her level. I thought that was really cool. It's just kind of a reversal of what you normally see. So it was really refreshing. I think it's really important. A lot of young people probably going to see this movie and maybe feel like I did. Maybe be more self-aware than I was when I was a kid. Also, Finn Wolfhard, he's in Stranger Things. He's really, really good.
Yeah.
I mean, just in everything. He's just good.
Yeah, great young actor. He's somebody that I foresee being, like, maybe another, like, Daniel Radcliffe or Tom Holland that we're going to see taking increasingly interesting roles mm-hmm. as he gets older and gets more opportunities in his career. So he's definitely somebody to watch.
Perhaps a Robert Pattinson?
I mean, yeah.
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 And also, let's not forget Logan Kim, who plays the character Podcast.
Oh, I love Podcast.
He might be my new hero.
Yeah.
My new mascot. He's great. He's talking about podcasts all the time. Love that. Love the character that's carrying around a recorder and
love it.
He's basically like a walking X-Files episode, which is great. Definitely do not skip out on that movie. If you've got young kids, they can watch it too. If you care at all about Ghostbusters, because I didn't even watch Ghostbusters when I was a kid. I didn't watch those movies until I was an adult. But if you care at all about them, if you know anything about Ghostbusters, it's going to be special. So definitely don't pass up that movie because of the crazy discussion surrounding it. Yeah. It's tons of fun. You'll like it. I don't think I've heard anybody say, I did. Well, nope, that's not true. Don't go, you guys, if you watch movies, just don't go online. Don't read comments.
Yeah, don't do it.
Don't be a part of message boards. Don't go on IMDb. Just watch a movie and make your opinions for yourself. Because I'm always going to be a proponent of that. Because there's just something about somebody who specifically wants to take the Mickey out of somebody else for loving a movie. It's like, just let me like what I like, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Scroll on. Scroll on past.
If you see something, just use your little scroll thing on your mouse.
Scroll away.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's it for the best of 2021. Got all right. of the major hits there, so.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, next time's a big one.
Oh my god, I'm so excited.
It's like the movie.
We've been talking about this movie since we freaking started this podcast, so I am really excited because Juliet hasn't watched it again yet, so I'm excited to bring her into 2022 Juliet versus 2018 Juliet. You've got 4 years of knowledge and wisdom.
I'm ready for it. I am ready for this experience.
You guys better get ready because we're excited.
Yeah.
Yay!
All right.
Happy 2022. Thanks for listening to Attack of the Final Girls. Find us online at attackofthefinalgirls.com, Attack of the Final Girls on Instagram, and on Twitter at Final Girls Pod.
Our theme music is by House Ghost and available on Rad Girlfriend Records.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And tell your friends about us.
I'm Julia.
And I'm Teresa. Until next time, stay scary.